This week's episode of the Autoblog Podcast is brought to you by the Autoblog Daily Digest. It's a great way to stay updated with what's happening in the world of cars in just 2 or 3 minutes every day. Ask your smart speaker for the Autoblog Daily Digest to stay up to speed with the latest car news, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. Joining me today is senior editor for All Things Green, John Snyder, and senior reporter and producer for our friends at Yahoo Finance, Pras Subramanian. John, how you doing, man?
I'm doing quite well. How about yourself?
Doing great. Doing great. Pras, welcome to the show. Glad to have you on.
Hey, man. I'm really glad to be here. Excited to be here. I'm a big fan of the podcast.
All right. Well, let's get into it. We've been driving some pretty interesting things. John was in the Chevy Bolt. You were the regular one, the EUV. So that's the,
yeah, the newer, the slightly longer one. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. And then of course, totally related, the 370Z Nismo, which is one of my favorite cars, actually. It's so old, but it's so much fun to drive. It still looks good, I think. Pras, you were in the Jeep Wrangler 4xe, which I'm super psyched to hear about. This is like basically the car I've been waiting for, which is an electric Wrangler. I think they still don't, you don't get too many miles of range out of it, but can't wait to hear about that. So we'll get into that. And I drove a Mitsubishi Eclipse Cross, which is pretty good car, kind of funky crossover. Check out some of the TikToks I did. It was a beautiful shade of red, and that's, you know, we'll leave it there. Let's see, run through some news. The Honda Civic dropped earlier last week. Mercedes-AMG Project One, they're still doing supercars. We'll do some news hits on that. Then we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on in the green infrastructure, just situation, if you will. Last month, we kind of missed Earth Day, if you will. Sometimes we usually do like a green podcast. So we'll do like a bit of a green like tint to this podcast, if you will. Pras did some reporting for Yahoo Finance. Check that out. We'll leave the link in the show notes so you can click over that if you'd like. But he kind of explains why some gas stations may not include EV chargers just yet. It's a really good read. Be sure to check it out. We're going to get into that in a little bit. Then we will talk a little bit about the Ultium 360. That's GM's powertrain that's going to go in a variety of their electric vehicles. Finally, we'll spend some money. Before that, though, we're going to talk about a used car listing, too. Can't forget that one. One of my personal favorites, this is the Genesis Coupe from back in the day, right when I sort of got into automotive journalism. This is one of the earlier press cars, if you will, one of the trips I did. So we spotlight used cars, things you might be able to find out there in the Autoblog listings. Gives you some ideas, things you might want to just start trolling the internet for, like, because we're always sort of in market. You know, I always am looking for an old Alpha Spider or something like that. So let's get into it. Pras, tell me about this 4xe. I'm super psyched.
You know, I've been looking forward to this truck for a while. I mean, I'm a big fan of Wranglers and, you know, kind of interested in how they're going to actually bring the car into the future, into kind of a green future. And, you know, I think it's a really good first effort by Jeep with this plug-in hybrid. You know, just first impressions driving it, the drivetrain really smooth. The electric motors are whisper quiet. There's two motors here combined with a turbocharged 4. And when that turbo 4 kicks in, it's actually not that intrusive either. It's pretty powerful, not too loud. I was surprised at how refined it was for, you know, kind of like a first effort here. You know, you got these features like e-save and electric and also hybrid. Those are your kind of three main driving modes. And I found myself mostly in e-save and hybrid. Hybrid, of course, mostly electric up to a certain, you know, almost like 40 miles an hour before that and motor kicks in. And I thought that I could actually save more of that battery power using e-save pretty easily. So I was able to kind of, you know, gauge that, toggle between hybrid and e-save to keep my electric power when I really needed it in kind of urban settings. Downsides, like you mentioned, Greg, you know, only 49 MPGe around that. And then, you know, 20 MPG combined. Not the greatest from what you'd expect from a plug-in hybrid, but you know, if you're only going to be in EV mode a lot and driving around town, you know, putzing around, you know, doing errands and stuff, it's not that bad. You know, price-wise, it's we had the Sahara 4xe. That was around 48K, 54K with options. So not cheap, but it does qualify for that $7,500 federal tax credit plus any kind of state and local credits you might get. So I think people should give it a shot, test drive it for sure. If you like electric cars, if you like hybrids, it's pretty cool. But one thing I want to note, and you guys might want to hear about this too, is the fact that they actually made it such that you can actually drive in all electric mode in off-road settings. So it's pretty capable in that regard too.
That's awesome. You know, the cars have been including that sort of save the charge button or whatever because of cities having zero emission zones or low emission zones. But it makes total sense to have it for, you know, save your electric charge for when you're off road and you want to creep through nature quietly and you know, maybe sneak up on some elk or something that you're trying to view. I think that's it makes me sort of think about the electric drive differently now that, you know, it's being used on an off-road vehicle. I think it's a natural fit for that sort of powertrain. I've always loved Jeeps and I've always loved EVs. So being able to drive electric in a Jeep is something I'm definitely looking forward to.
You know, what was really cool is actually I had the top down and I had an EV mode and it was whisper quiet. I mean,
that's fantastic.
I was gliding along. You could hear everything. I can only imagine what that's like in a national park or a super off-road setting.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
You really can get the Wrangler in a lot of different flavors right now too. You know, you're talking a Turbo 4, the Pedestar V6, the 392 V8, which that review just went up. And of course, a plug-in hybrid now. And I forgot the diesel too. Mm-hmm. So I think Jeep's doing a really good job keeping the Wrangler competitive with, you know, because the Bronco is right there at the gates, you know. And it's literally one of the hottest vehicles out there, just looking at like what everybody says, looking at traffic, looking at just all the buzz. But the Wrangler is still really compelling. So, you know, I think this is one of those situations where it's good for all off-road enthusiasts or on-road enthusiasts. You know, you know, the rising tide is sort of lifting all boats, which is a great thing. So, you know, I think it's also a good thing too, to really, you know, Pross, I think you touched on something that really is like salient here, that this is a good first effort. I expect them to add more range, make this more efficient. I mean, I hope they will, because these numbers are a little underwhelming out of the gate. But considering they're working with a pretty old footprint that, you know, was designed, you know, years ago, I think there's certainly room to really, you know, really improve. And that will be exciting. You know, in all electric off-road adventure, sign me up. That sounds great.
And I love that you can lift it. You know, they've already got a factory lift for the 4xe, lifting it 2 inches without, you know, screwing with any of the powertrain stuff. There's no, you know, in-wheel hub motors or anything that might get thrown off out of whack by messing with the chassis. So yeah, it'll be cool to see what other, they've always got so many good aftermarket Mopar parts lists for the Wrangler. So it'll be cool to see what sort of 4xe specific aftermarket pieces they offer for it.
What did you do with the 4xe, Pross?
Well, you know, in New York State, unfortunately, you can't take a vehicle off road unless it's like private land. You can't go on public land, so I didn't really have much of an opportunity to do any kind of really fun mud rut type things, mostly on road. I did forget to mention that it is 21 miles of all electric range. So, and it's like a 17 or 18 kilowatt hour battery. So, you know, like you said, it's not that, you know, extensive in terms of how far it can go on all electric power, but you know, it's just the beginning. And I'm surprised to be able to kind of port this stuff onto the existing Jeep platform and do it in a way that I thought worked pretty nicely. So maybe next time I'll be able to get some actual off-road fun with this car, because electric power is great with all that low end torque.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, this is not cheap, but I will say this, Jeeps are not cheap. I mean, they really aren't, unless you get like, you know, the really base vehicles. They're not cheap. So I think this is pretty compelling. I I go back and forth. I tend to keep cars for a long time, so it's like I might wait it out, see if they can get a little bit more efficiency, a little more range out of it. I might not. I mean, 22 miles is not bad. I mean,
that isn't bad. I mean, it's more than the Subaru Crosstrek Hybrid, which is only 17 miles, and that's you know, from a crunchy granola brand too, that you would expect to, you know, maybe come out of the gate with a little bit more range than that. So it's impressive that for a big heavy Wrangler, you know, 20 miles isn't bad at all.
It would serve my purposes, just, you know, as far as daily driving, and then just get where you need to go and plug it in, and there you go. I mean, I personally think I would am looking actively at chargers for my house whenever we, like, sort of, you know, go down that road of what our next car might be, and it will likely be probably a plug-in hybrid. Probably not a full plug-in, just because, you know, it wouldn't necessarily fit my family's use case, but plug-in hybrid, I think, is very compelling for a lot of people. So that's the 4xe. Let's shift gears to another electric vehicle. This is the Chevy Bolt. You spent some time in it there, appropriately, Mr. Green Editor. Mm-hmm. This is a bit of a different take on the Bolt than, you know, sort of the very, like, compact car. I know they called it a crossover, but it was kind of like, you're like almost choking, stifling a grin when they're like, this is a crossover. It's like, okay.
Yeah, this still doesn't feel it. The Bolt EUV has about 3 extra inches in wheelbase.
Okay.
Which pretty much entirely goes to rear seat legroom, which the Bolt needed. So it's good to have that extra room in the Bolt EUV. it's about 6 inches longer overall. It's no taller than the regular Bolt, apart from the EUV has roof rails. So I half wonder why they didn't just scrap the smaller Bolt entirely, because the Bolt EUV is better. But they did lower the price on the Bolt, so I could see them sort of, you know, after mulling it over, I can sort of see them keeping it around as, you know, that if you just want a basic commuter with a ton of range, you know, 259 miles, you get the basic Bolt. But the Bolt EUV is it's nicer. It's more roomy, and you only lose like 9 miles of range. Like when you're going 250 miles between charges, 9 miles isn't really that big of a deal. The cool thing about the EUV though is in the higher trim, you can get Super Cruise as a $2,000 option. It's the first car outside of Cadillac to get Super Cruise, and it is. They have improved Super Cruise by adding more roads that it's operable on, it's tens of thousands at least more miles of roads, and it can do sort of divided trunk roads, and I tested that out and it works really, really well. I mean, we tested it out on the CT6 and found it worked really great back then in its first iteration, and it works really well in the Chevy Bolt too. It's a really good system. I love that it monitors the driver, make sure you're paying attention. I feel like that should be required of any hands-free system. Pretty much all of them do use that, but it should be like mandated, in my opinion, until you can get to a point where the car is level 4 or level 5 autonomous. Then you obviously wouldn't need to monitor the driver because you wouldn't even have to have a driver. Super Cruise works really well, takes a lot of the stress out of driving. You can just sort of take your hands off the wheel, your feet off the pedals, and all you're doing is just scanning the road in front of you. And you know, with this little bit longer wheelbase, it feels the EUV feels, you know, just slightly more stable, a little more it tracks straighter down the highway. Although with Super Cruise on, it tracks pretty straight anyway. But yeah, it's you know, it's a nicer interior than before, and it's a shame that There aren't any more $7,500 tax credits to give away for GM, but they're sort of making up for that by lowering their costs and passing those savings on to the consumer to make the both bolts still pretty competitive.
It's kind of an interesting problem for GM to have. You know, they actually, it's like they and Tesla are in that boat where they were among the early companies that really started producing EVs at scale, and they sold a lot of them. So for consumers, that's, you know, and it's a kind of a sliding scale too, because, you know, you really need to talk to your accountant and find out if, hey, the $7,500 rebate is going to actually do anything for you, or tax credit, that sort of thing. And it's, I think it's encouraging too. If you look at the Bolt, it is reasonably priced for what it is, for all the tech you get, for the range you get. It seems like GM has figured out how to produce this at scale, like I said. But also, I mean, I'd be very curious to find out if they make money on every Bolt they sell. You know, it seems like, and if they aren't, they're at least willing to maybe take a hit now to be in the field, which I think is, that's totally smart. They made like, what, $3 billion according to the latest earnings? Yeah, take a loss on one or two car lines. Just to be there.
Sell enough trucks to make up for it.
Yeah, exactly. Curious about the view, like in New York there, Prost. Do people think of like the Chevy Bolt as an electric car option, or is it all Tesla or some other things? Because I know, you know, Chevy has struggled, you know, on some of the coasts, both of the two that line our country. do people think of the Bolt as an option? When they're looking for a green car?
You know, I hate to say it, but I don't think they do, Greg. You know, the Bolt is sort of anonymous, right? We had the prior generation, we tested it out, and I think, John, you mentioned that they did improve the interior, right? Because I didn't like the interior of the older one. It was just seemed too, like, space-agey, or I don't know what they were trying to do. But it seems like out here, the Taycan has been getting a lot of buzz here amongst people that I'm, you know, talking to, and people that I meet anecdotally that are really excited about trying that out. And of course, Tesla's just the 800-pound gorilla in the room. So I think if you want to stand out, at least in the coasts out here, it's got to have some buzz. And I think that the Bolt is just too, you know, under the radar, and it's just utilitarian. And the new EUV looks pretty cool, but I think it's not like enough to kind of to move the needle on, are you going to get me out of a Tesla and into a Chevy Bolt?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the Bolt is anonymous even in the Midwest, and they build it here. You know, I think part of the issue is it's kind of small. You know, we would, like I said, we were looking at an electric car for our family, and it's not on the list because it's just too small. You know, I have a golden retriever. She'd take up the entire back seat. You know, like it's a little bit anonymous, despite the fact, I think, you know, again, the proficiency is there. You know, the miles you get out of it is pretty prodigious. I haven't been in this car like you have, John, but I'm glad to hear they cleaned up the interior. The last gen was really, like you said there, Prost, kind of out there, which is something I think GM does with its electric cars. Like, if you remember the first gen Bolt, it looked like a science experiment, and it was cool. I actually really liked that first gen Volt. And then they rolled it around. It was like, it kind of looks like a Chevy Cruze for the second gen. And that's fine. It is what it is. But I thought they kind of lost some of that novelty that I thought was actually kind of good. When I buy an electric car, I want to at least maybe have the option of standing out. You know, everything doesn't have to be anonymous. You know, you only live once, right? Let's show off that you're buying an electric car, right?
Yeah, it's funny. Some companies are going for that. Others aren't. I feel like Audi, especially, tries to sort of downplay the EV-ness in its looks and in the way they drive. That everything is super familiar. It's Audi first, EV second. But yeah, I tend to agree that I want my EV to sort of feel different. I want it to feel different. I mean, it's special. It drives different. I want it to feel different in other ways too. You know, take advantage of that technology, make it stand out.
You guys think that maybe Ford's done a better job here with the Mustang Mach-E in terms of, like, get, you know, using that controversially, using that name and sort of the design aesthetic to make it more supercharged, make it more exciting, make it more like, what's that all about? Even though it's, you know, a bit higher higher price model than your Bolt.
Yeah, I think so. I had the Mach-E about, probably 2 months ago. It was pretty cold out, and everybody would walk by my house and look at it. And it's like, some was good, some was bad. People were just kind of all over the place with it. But yeah, I think the net result of using Mustang on an EV, to me, that's 100% fine. Using it on the crossover, to me, was a little more, controversial. But, so it goes. There have been Mustangs in all different forms, some of them good, some of them not so good. And I think that's okay, because it really got that conversation going and that got you interested in the car. And I thought the Mach-E is an absolute home run. I drove it and I was really impressed with it. It maybe is my favorite thing I've driven this year for a variety of reasons. And I also drove the Aston Martin DBX right afterwards. So I've been in some pretty hot metal. But yeah, I think that was a good move. You drove the Mach-E, didn't you, Pross?
Yeah. We tested it in also cold weather environments. The range was a little bit tricky, but
yeah,
very impressed. I mean, fit and finish, interior was wonderful. Mm-hmm. I do like the exterior. I know some people don't necessarily like it so much, but I thought it looked great, very sporty, and to the point that in between is the sports car, sporty SUV versus that CUV. Thought it kind of hit that middle, thread the needle nicely there. I thought I drove great. So I was a big fan. I just wasn't a fan necessarily of the range that wasn't as great as I thought it would be. Granted, it was very cold up here when I tested it.
Yeah, same. It was literally, I got in the car, and it was like, I think it was 10 degrees on a February afternoon when I was driving it. And I mean, we're talking like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And the range, it just basically, there was a little bit of parasitic loss overnight. I also, to be fair, wasn't exactly sure when they dropped it off. The fleet guys dropped the cars off. I forget why. I was not able to go out and mark the level of charge. So that was a little ambiguous for me. So then I actually took out the portable charger that comes with the car. And I sort of did my range testing off of that. But once I was driving it, I was pretty impressed with it. I was able to get a good 60 mile drive out of it the first time, and then another 20 mile range. And you could do some things too to tweak it, if you will, turn off all of the heat, and just wear a heavy coat, which I didn't do the first time. The first time I got in the car and I'm like, it's 10 degrees. Let's park up. Let's drive this thing. But later on, I'm like, okay, let's turn the heat down, try and save some stuff. And, the Mach-E has a variety of ranges and, performance. I think it's a very impressive portfolio too. In the hundreds of miles, I don't know it off the top of my head, but I just scratched the surface of what I could have done. And, I thought their portable charger that was under the trunk, deck lid, if you will, pretty nice. Plugged it right in, worked great.
I was siphoning off whenever I go to a restaurant, find a little spot to plug in, do that, because I was upstate and it was in upstate New York, because there's just not many chargers at all. So I was just literally plugging at the hotel, plugging in at the restaurant, just trying to siphon up power. And then that became like some session where I was like, yeah, I'm getting a little power here, all excited. And people were like, what's wrong with this guy? And I got 20 miles of this. There's a microbrew. It's like, geez, this gamification of it also becomes an element, and checking the apps, where I'm at. So it's new and it's interesting, but also a little bit nerve wracking sometimes.
I'm right there with you as far as siphoning different amounts of power off too. I did it for my house, but I've never been this engaged in just the EV lifestyle. It was like, okay, got to plug the car in. We're going to leave the garage open because I didn't set up my whole charging, garage infrastructure. And by that, I mean, I left a bunch of Christmas decorations in the middle of the garage. So it was such a pain to get the car hooked up. But yeah, no, it's a really good lifestyle. And then if you want to seek out a full on, charging station, you could do it. You can Ford, I believe, sells one, which you could get some of the local utilities have credits for those, which is, I think, a really good way for the power companies, because, hey, they want you to use their power. But if they're going to incentivize you, well, OK, that'll at least get me thinking about how I can make it work. It's interesting about the Mach-E Charger, not to go too deep here, but I was like really kind of debating, like, would I buy an actual level 2 charger? Though ironically, I think it's being recalled or something. They had some issues with it. Or would I just use the portable one? Because the portable one is very good. Like, I was able to get 10 miles of range just plugging it in for a few hours. So I went back and forth, and my sort of calculus was, yeah, I'd probably get the level 2 one, put it in my garage, have a base, and do it that way. And then I'd lug the other one around with me just in case I could, you know, siphon some charge from somewhere. Although I guess it would also depend on what my office did and that sort of thing. I don't know. You guys have any thoughts on what you would do with that?
Well, the great thing is certain automakers offer, 110, 120 volt plus 240 volt plugs on that mobile charger. So if you've got a plug in your garage for 240 volt, you can just use that mobile charger right there. I know Nissan has one. Chevy has one for the Bolt now, and they will actually pay, under reasonable conditions to have a 240 volt socket installed in your garage, as long as it's not like in a barn, you know, detached 200 feet from your house or something like that. So in cases like that, you know, why even bother? But yeah, I think if I didn't have a 240 volt mobile charger, I would definitely get a level 2 charger in my house, just because I'll be out for a long drive and I will have depleted all the range, and then get home, unpack the car, and I need to run to the grocery store because, you know, we've been up at our cottage and there's nothing to eat. So I'll still need to be able to do stuff, or, you know, someone that hurts themselves. It's always the kid or an animal getting hurt, and I'll have to run out. And I just need that peace of mind of having that range that I can add quickly at home.
You know, a colleague of mine got a XC90 plug-in hybrid, and she, her husband or her, they have a house upstate. I think Volvo supplied them with like some sort of 240 watt or level 2 type of charger that they, I don't think they charged them for, because I think it was a lease car, but they installed it, her electrician installed it, and it didn't cost them anything, and they used that. I don't think it's full level 2 though. I think, John, you know more about this than I do. I think it's like maybe it's just a 240 watt. I'm not exactly positive.
Yeah, it's 240 volt. I think it depends on, you know, basically the onboard charger in the car, and, you know, it depends on, you know, your home's electricity and how it's all set up. But yeah, our Volvo S80 plug-in hybrid that we had a mobile charger that had, the 110 volt, the regular outlet, plus, you know, you could pop that off and pop on the 240 volt one. I didn't have a 240 volt outlet to plug it into, but if you did, you can just, yeah, it charges pretty quick with that.
Cool. So let's do a hard fade over here to the opposite of cutting edge technology and talk about the 370Z, a car that's probably old enough to drink at this point. You drove it in Nismo trim, John. Yeah. I got to be honest with you. I do love the 370Z. I just think the Z car is so much fun, despite its faults. How is it in its most recent form?
Completely familiar, like totally unchanged, super ancient. But, I still think it's super charming. It's very good looking still. That design is pretty timeless. And yeah, it's still a blast to drive. Very engaging. With a 6-speed manual, it's a hoot. You can really ring out that V6. And, you know, this was one of the first cars I drove that would, if you put it in sport mode, it would rev match the downshifts for you, so you don't have to heel toe, which, you know, I almost never do anyway. But it has that, and there's still not a lot of cars, I feel like, that do that. I don't know if maybe consumers don't really care, but I kind of like it. But yeah, really fun car. The Nismo, though, in Michigan on our highways with, you know, the frost heaves and the potholes, it is downright punishing, the suspension. Just, you know, you talk about, you know, cars with harsh suspensions and your fillings coming out. You know, it's sort of an embellishment, exaggeration, but, you know, I could actually feel my teeth in my mouth going over these bumps in the Nismo. I was glad I got a last hurrah with it, since it's going away. But, you know, 1 week was enough. 1 week was plenty. But my son Wally loved it. It's the second car he's been in where I've had to put the car seat in the front because there was no back seat. And he just asked me for a ride any chance he could get. Anytime I was going to the store or something, "Dad, can I come?" Really, it made me very, it nourished my soul to have my son get excited about a car that is just all car. You know, it's not a piece of technology, it's not appliance, it's a car. You have to drive it, and it's just pure mechanical joy. I'm looking forward to what comes next, but this one is, you know, super ancient. The tech is really old, you know, but I feel like if Nissan could have updated maybe the infotainment and some other things, maybe put some more creature comforts in there, they could have maybe kept rolling with this platform for a little while longer. But, you know, on to bigger, better things.
Yeah, I think there may have been room to eke out another few years out of this car, but, you know, they made enough of them. If you certainly are in the market, you can always find probably a pretty good used one. A big fan of the Z car. I really am. It was, you know, again, another car that goes back to like when I got into the car writing business, at least some of the early years. I remember we had a press car when I was at Auto Week, and we were going to put it on the cover for the LA Auto Show. And we had the car, but the car had not yet been revealed. So it was like sitting in the basement of the parking garage, and it was like, you could drive it, but you can't write about it and don't break it. So, you know, there was always that. It's funny how stuff like that tends to sort of stay with you, if you will. And thankfully, for nostalgia's sake, the car barely changed in the ensuing, what was that, 08? So 13 years over that time span. That gearbox, though, I think is still really good. Steering is really good. I think it's a sharp looking car too. You know, I would put it in the category of cars like, you know, everything from the last generation Corvette to even the 911, cars that don't need to change much and looks pretty good, you know? So eager to see what comes next. We can close out the review section here with a quick hit on the Mitsubishi Eclipse Cross. I drove this last week. It was a pretty handsome car. It is red diamond with a black interior, so, you know, quite attractive. Pretty good value, I think. Mine stickered for about just under 35 grand. That included like the SEL touring package with some like body colored garnishes and some, you know, special bumpers, things like that. And a few tech things like a sunroof, the panoramic sunroof, ACC, things like that. 1.5 liter turbo 4, which was pretty good, I think. You know, all in all, it was a fun little crossover, to be honest. You know, there's a lot of things in that segment that you're going to want to consider with it, including probably ones like, you know, the HRV or the CHR from Toyota, which was actually supposed to be a Scion, if you remember the backstory there. It's not a particularly, I'd say, amazing segment, so this is something you might want to take a look at. You know, you might like the styling. You might like, you know, the interior, like I said, was pretty good. It takes a little bit of mental recalibration to pay 35 grand for something this size. But overall, it was pretty nice. You know, I drove the Mitsubishi Outlander a while back, and I was impressed with that. These are two pretty important vehicles to sort of like, you know, not relaunch the brand, but like, you know, get them back in like the public conscious with some new vehicles and, you know, just remind everybody, hey, you know, here's, you know, this different take in these segments that, you know, you might like. And I found them, again, to be styled up very nicely, you know, very angular, mm-hmm. you know, especially the bright colors. So, yeah, I mean, definitely not as remarkable a drive as, you know, the 4xe or some of the other things we've talked about. But it's competitive. And I feel like that segment is, you know, again, pretty wide open. So, you know, there's things, if you're interested, like, in this segment, it's worth a look, you know, if you will. You know, the Rogue Sport isn't exactly, you know, a home run hitter. So, like, there's opportunities. There's things, like, if you say, hey, I want something, you know, a little bit different, this might be the car for you. So,
you know, real quick, that the name Eclipse, that brings back a lot of memories for me, because when I was in high school and stuff, those are the hot cars to get. That if you had a Mitsubishi Eclipse, you were the man, right? So it's funny that they, you know, port that name now onto the crossover, but just funny to bring back that.
Hey, everyone's doing it. Look at, yeah, you know, Mustang.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, Chevy, the Blazer is now a midsize crossover. Yeah, names are, you know, I think car companies need to use, frankly, their strongest names. So, like you, I had to do a little mental gymnastics to try to figure out, oh, right, I'm driving this small crossover. That's not what I would maybe have originally associated the Eclipse name with. But, yeah, we'll see. I mean, I think it's a good foundational piece for Mitsubishi. I would love to see them bring back, you know, the Evo, something like that. That would be great. Sure. I was a big fan of that, you know. Even though by the time they did sort of, you know, let it go away, you want to talk about a rough car. That was a rough car as far as like filling rattlings and things like that. But I mean, that dual clutch transmission was brilliant. Steering was amazing. The interior was okay for its time, if you will. But I mean, they did things on the Evo that like made it feel special and fun. You know, it was something you could at least compete against some of those, like, you know, faster sedans from Subaru and the like. So, you know, I have kind of a soft spot for that car in particular. Not everybody, I think a lot of people maybe thought it was a little too extreme for like the price and for like, you know, against other things you could get. But I really like that car too. So how about we talk some news? Let's run through the news hits here. We'll get into a couple. Just kind of do this somewhat quickly, quick reactions. John, you wrote about the 2022 Honda Civic. They cleaned it up a little bit. And you're going to be driving it like next week. So this is kind of a preview.
Yep.
Why don't you give us some initial impressions here of what they've done, and then we'll touch on the rest when you actually drive the car.
Sure. It looks fairly familiar from the outside. They cleaned up. I feel like the last Civic, last gen, was, you know, they paid the designers by the line. This one is a little more clean, you know, fewer lines, fewer, you know, curves and creases, which I think, you know, it just looks a lot cleaner, a lot sleeker. But inside, it looks really nice. It looks very simple, but they've upgraded some of the tech. It's slightly larger than before. It seems like it's not too crazy different from the past Civic, but we will see when I get in it. But it looks promising. there's two motors. There's the two cylinder I4, the naturally aspirated, and then the upgrade motor is a 1.5 liter turbo 4. That one makes 180 horsepower. You know, pretty good fuel economy across the board. They've stiffened up the body, improved the suspension. So it might, you know, we'll see, but it should, hopefully, ride and handle better than the last one too. So cool. Fingers crossed.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Civic right now is, you know, it looks good, it drives well. They did a lot with this generation to really like add some different flavors to it, body styles. So I think they're in a good place. And I feel like Honda's design is really pretty strong right now too. The Civic and the Accord, I think, are at or near the top of their segment as far as just like style, tastemakers. They're, you know, it's something that Honda, it took a while for them to sort of get to this, I'd say, level. You know, a Civic was, I think, pretty generic even up until like, you know, the early part of the last decade. But now they've really dialed it up, and I applaud that. I think it's fun. It's, you know, it makes it, if you're going to buy a compact car, it makes it a little more interesting. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to, you know, this is just the first taste of it. This is just a sedan. And it's not, you know, the SI or anything like that. I'm looking forward to, you know, when they come out with a hatchback version too, and, you know, we get to start to see things like the Type R, then it'll get pretty exciting.
One of my neighbors has a Type R, and whenever I'm walking around the dog, I always try to, I'm like, hey, why don't you kind of stop here, stiff around this tree so I can stare at the Type R, just because it's just, I think it's a lot, but it's a good looking car, yeah. I think.
Agreed.
So good looking car is also the AMG Project One. Mercedes is still doing supercars. They're getting close to production here. It's insane, some of the specs here. It's a hybrid, but it's a 1.6 liter V6. But you're going to get 1,100 horsepower out of this whole thing. You should definitely check out the piece that associate editor Byron Hurd wrote end of last week, where we've got some spy shots on this thing. I'm curious, what do you guys think of just the supercar market? We talk about this one, but I mean, just in general, like, is this a good place for companies like Mercedes to be sort of dabbling in? Is this a waste of resources? I mean, I'm generally okay with it just because, frankly, Mercedes does tend to parachute in and out of it. You know, they had the SLS. Mm-hmm. They had the, you know, other ones before that, obviously. But I think, yeah, sure. You know, you're Mercedes. You've got a lot of money. You've got all this racing heritage. You have a Formula One team. You might as well do this.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you, Greg, on that. I mean, you know, Mercedes is, you know, they dabbled with McLaren, right, with that one supercar. And I think that it boosts their profile amongst those German high-end luxury, you know, sports brands, right? With the Project One in particular, I mean, I'm an F1 fan, so this car is pretty cool. Obviously, that engine is nuts, 11,000 yeah. RPM. I mean,
yeah,
you know, and has the MGU-H, the MGU-K, like all that F1 technology in there. So I think it has, like, you know, it's an homage to, or not much, but it's like a, hey, recognizing our F1 exploits and our wins for many years now. So I think it's a pretty cool way to tie that all together. But I hear you on the fact that, like, we're seeing so many supercars out there. How many more do we need, right? How many more 1,000 plus horsepower electric, you know, Lotus Evijas do I need, right? Or the new, you know, the Chirons, right? So, yeah, we're hitting peak supercar, but hey, if people are buying them, I can't knock out a manufacturer for making them. I'm just getting kind of like, when we were kids, it was like the Countach and the Tesserosa, right? That was it. Now it's like 80 of them.
Yeah, I think the only thing that I really care about is, like you said, 11,000 RPM. Anytime a car company wants to, you know, make something, a consumer car that revs to 11,000 RPM, I'm on board.
Yeah, that's just, that is insane. That's pretty stratospheric, if you will. I drove a Countach once, and when you talk about like cars when you're kids and like a bit of a dream, that was a total like dream. Yeah. It was a video shoot, actually. So you have video of me like wrenching the wheel and you can't see out of it. You're like laying down and it looks like I'm going like 100 miles an hour, but I'm really going like 30, I think, at this like deserted like cruise ship terminal in Miami. But total tangent. But yeah, that, I mean, that's why covering cars is fun, is every now and then you get to drive a car like the AMG Project One. You know, sometimes this stuff does sort of come across your desk. So yeah. All right, let's go back to the business side of things. First of all, check this piece out on Yahoo Finance. nice job here, Pras. Really nicely reported. A lot of, you know, good details in here. Again, we'll share the link in the show notes here. But take us through why gas stations may not have EV chargers anytime soon.
So, you know, just the origination of the story was our editor-in-chief, Andy Server, was just harping on, why can't I charge electric car at a gas station? Why isn't that a possibility yet? And he said, look into it. And I said, okay, I will. So, you know, just kind of looking at it from a few different points of view, you know, it's economics, right? That's a big part of it. You know, Phillips 66, their chief economist, talked about how it doesn't make sense for them to have these chargers at their, you know, over 6,000 locations because, you know, A, it's too expensive for for consumers to use. It would just be too costly. And B, you know, they would need to have, you know, massive fleet operators using their charge stations like at scale for it to make sense economically for that build out. So it's economics, it's infrastructure, right? It's utilities that don't have the ability to provide that kind of high voltage charging at all these gas stations. They have to build all that out. You know, and there's maybe over 100,000 gas stations in the country. It would be an insane, you know, infrastructure build out. But, you know, with the Biden administration here, we're going to possibly see that, but not right away. So I think that's a big reason why it's economics, it's infrastructure. It's there's just not enough electric cars out there yet for that to be scale. And it probably makes more sense. And Johnny, you probably know about this more than I do. It probably makes sense to charge at home. It's just not economic or, common sense wise. It doesn't make sense to charge in a location that's not your home, which takes time.
Yeah, I think, something like 90% of charging takes place at home. And that's one of the great things about EVs is that you can fuel them at home. Stopping for fuel is an inconvenience. But you know, you do need chargers on the road if you're going to try and, you know, go on a road trip with your EV. And that's a reason why people aren't buying EVs is because of, you know, range. So it's sort of a chicken and the egg sort of problem but you know, like you said, there's just not enough EVs there yet, and the money's in gas, and that eventually there will be more chargers, and things like convenience stores will have to pop up around them because when you're stopping for 20, 30 minutes to get like 100 miles into your car, you need something to do, and what better way to kill time than to, you know, eat or, you know, browse a store. So eventually, there will be EV sort of convenience stations. I don't know that they'll be paired with gas stations. There was a couple years ago a gas station, a really old, like 61-year-old gas station that replaced all its gas pumps with EV chargers. And I'm kind of wondering how they are feeling about that now. I should go back and sort of follow up with them. Cause that seemed like maybe they jumped too early onto that, bandwagon when there's really not, enough demand for it. I'd be curious. I know they got a bunch of grant money to do it, but are they making any money now? I don't know.
Yeah, we'll say quickly. Talking about just how this all works mechanically and stuff, and just power wise. You know, Elon Musk talked about this in the earnings call for Tesla last week about the Powerwall and how they're only going to install they're only going to install solar installations with Powerwall backups. And I think that kind of makes sense because it's a way to like just collect that solar power that you can't necessarily that utilities can't collect and put in batteries. And if you can do that in locations that have and have the highest storage batteries, collect that power, keep it there and charge cars on demand, maybe that helps than relying on a utility to build that out. So we'll see.
Yeah, infrastructure to me is the biggest single question we face is, you know, the industry and society looks at transitioning to electric vehicles. You know, gas stations are a natural, perhaps, extension of that strategy. But also, you know, many fuel stations are independently owned, obviously they're connected literally to big oil. So there's a little bit of a conundrum there. But the other point that you guys both touched on that I think is really valid is you can charge at home or maybe your place of business or somewhere, even like, you know, a lot of sort of like the suburbs around Metro Detroit. They'll have these little downtowns, if you will, and it's like you can charge almost at like, you know, parking meters, things like that. Mm-hmm. So that's like sort of an incremental thing. But I'm kind of wondering too, is like when you get into that range anxiety where you're too far from your home to actually charge something, you know, then what does it look like? Is it like this big like rest area, you know, going like upstate in New York, or as we say up north here in Michigan? And you chill out for 30 minutes, get like a quick charge, and then continue on your way. And then when you get to your cottage, your cabin, you plug in your car. Is that the model? I don't know. But it's in some ways, it's interesting because there's still like a little bit of an adventure element to driving an electric car. Like, yeah. Are you going to make it? Well, hopefully you do. And, you know, with good planning, it's hopefully not too harrowing. But you know, it's different. You know, again, the percentage of the market is so small right now that I think it's still a unique, fun, cool thing to do, to be really, you know, not to cheerlead that segment of the, you know, industry, but it's still a pretty fun thing, you know, if you want to make it your thing.
Yeah, you mentioned that game. It's like that Seinfeld where Kramer is driving around with like the gas light on, and see how far you can go. And it's like, keep going. Yeah. We can do it, you know. So
been there in many occasions. All right. So one thing we should mention too, I'll mention this and we'll move on here, is General Motors did sign a deal. They announced this last week, basically to, you know, link up a number of their things to like streamline charging. So check that out on Autoblog. My guess is you guys cover that at Yahoo Finance as well. But I think it's interesting that they did do agreements with seven companies. You know, you're talking about EV Connect, ChargePoint, Blink Charging, and a few others, because they are like, I think it's smart for OEMs not to wait around and hope government or just their buyers figure it out. You know, Tesla has really figured out with their supercharger network at least how to create an ecosystem, if you buy a Tesla, uh-huh, how to charge it. So I think GM is trying to do the same thing. So that's our green segment. Let's move over here real quickly to our used car listing of the week. Last week, you did the 2010 to 2016 Genesis Coupe. Speaking of analog cars, that's what this one is. Pretty raw. I personally like the R-Spec trim that they offered for a while. My taste was the Turbo 4 and the 6-speed manual, but the V6 was a bit more powerful. In those cars. I don't think they ever put a V8 in it, except for maybe SEMA they did, like with Reese Millen and some of those guys. But why don't you take us through it there, John?
Well, I was on a road trip, about a month ago, and I saw two of these on the road. And from a distance, it almost looked like a Genesis G70. But then once I got close, I'm like, oh my gosh, it's a Genesis Coupe. And I just had so many good memories of driving those around. Super fun cars, terrible manual transmission. but, you know, they made some improvements to it about halfway through its life cycle. Tons of power. I mean, the 2.0 was plenty powerful. But yeah, that V6 was where it's at. But, you know, you can get them for decent prices. And, you know, there's actually quite a few of them out there. And they're popular with tuners. There's lots of aftermarket support for them still. So just a fun car. I remember it was just a really chuckable car. but yeah, there's, you know, driving the Nissan 370Z also had me thinking back to this, because that was, you know, they're similar in flavor, but I just remember when Genesis, for a little while, they had the Tiburon, which was front wheel drive, and then this was sort of like the next evolution of that, and it was rear wheel drive, and it was a blast.
Cool. Check this piece out. This went up last week on Autoblog. We actually have another one up. We're really churning these things out. We did one just yesterday on the Lincoln Blackwood, which is the Lincoln F-150 that you may not remember, but it was a thing, probably quite lucrative, but it also sort of proved the theory that people don't really want a luxury truck. You just buy the highest level F-150 or Ram or Silverado, and that's what you get.
Yeah, I mean, those are basically luxury vehicles. You know, they're just this one, the Blackwood had sort of a weird had that split tailgate, and I think the bed was carpeted.
It was super weird. And the graining on the fenders, like, what was that?
Yeah, it was weird, but it was cool. I mean, when you see them now, I always get excited because, you know, they made them for 1 year, yeah. I think. And yeah, I mean, they're neat now.
Lincoln had a weird turn of the century, right? So they had the Zephyr for like 1 year, and then it became the MKZ, I want to say. Yeah, that would make sense, the Z. They did this truck for a while. You might remember the Lincoln, was it the LS car? That was like a rear-wheel drive. I think it was a V8 sedan. That was like a legit, pretty good, semi-sporty Lincoln that I'm sure the world has forgotten about. But if you want to drive a sleeper car, pull up to a light in one of those, and you're in this 20-year-old Lincoln that could probably move a little bit. So, you know, that's kind of random. So
I think there was a Neiman Marcus. I'm looking at a Neiman Marcus version of the Blackwood. Yes. They had the carpeted interior.
Then had to go with the Ford Explorers. There were Eddie Bauer versions, right?
Yeah.
Man. 90s, late 90s, early 2000s, trip to the mall here with like the Ford Motor Company here. On that note, should we spend some money?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, let's do it. This comes from Brian M., longtime listener, writing in because here's the scenario. Just about to finish up his master's program. Congratulations. Have a job lined up. Even better. Looking to finally get a nicer car as my graduation present to myself. I currently have an 09 Cadillac DTS, daily long drive road trip car, an 83 Supra. That's a fun weekend car. Hell yeah, it is. And a 91 Mercedes 190E that he's about to sell. While the Cadillac is a great long-distance cruiser and a surprisingly nice engine note, I believe that's the North Star. So yeah, that was a pretty good engine. It lacks something in the enjoyment of twisty national park roads, nor is it particularly unique. Yeah, come to Michigan. You still see plenty of DTSs rolling around. So my question is, what are the best GT cars in the 20 to 25K range, preferably manual, with comfortable seats and just an overall nice place to hang out for long periods of time? We can stretch it to 30,000, but it's got to be pretty cool. It justifies selling the Supra and consolidating into one car. Here are the choices. Current number one is the 987 Porsche Cayman. I like the Cayman almost across the board. That's a good one. Mm-hmm. The E39 M5. But he sort of admits that that's a little bit higher price, hard to potentially finance. That's a thing. Okay. Some of the non-negotiables, not a fan of convertibles, and would like something interesting and unique. Feel free to think outside of the box. So, Pross, why don't we kick it over to you?
You know, I think that I'm with you, Greg. The Cayman probably the best option. But, you know, these days, those cars are pushing. I don't know if you guys seen, like, you know, modern classics these days are going crazy in terms of pricing, right? The Cayman, that the M5 is great. I mean, I think other options, if you're looking, if you can push the 30, maybe in a Lotus Elise, maybe an E46 M3. But I also think, and you know, he said he didn't like convertibles, but the Honda S2000, right? I mean,
yeah,
maybe
talk about high revving.
That was exactly, a brilliant car. Yeah, get the Club Racer, and you've got a convertible right there, or a collectible right there. I'm picturing one I drove that was bright. I want to say bright yellow. Back in the day, that's a really good car. Cool.
And I've never driven an S2000, but I heard it's got the actual manual transmission is actually linked directly into the transmission. It's not a cable, right? It's like a very like direct feeling shift.
Yeah.
That is, again, one of the most brilliant gearboxes. Maybe brilliant, but it's intense. Let me put it that way. God, if I lived like maybe in the middle of nowhere and had some open roads, that would be like a short list that I'd put on like in my like theoretical barn, if you will, that you walk out to Saturday morning at dawn. There's an S2000 in there. There's probably an old Porsche, probably an old Mercedes. You know, I would probably throw in something like a 62 Cadillac, just all sorts of things. I digress. John would have an Oldsmobile. But good choices there. Over to you there, John.
Well, since he was considering the E39 M5, I was looking at 2018 Kia Stingers. Those are, there's more and more Kia Stingers hitting the used market now. Some of them are most of them are, sort of begin at like about 25,000, so 25 to 30, might be pushing up there a little bit, but it's a sort of a newer car. Great grand touring vehicle, especially if you want to bring more people with you. There's plenty of room, tons of room in that fastback and that hatchback sort of thing. A great car for some long distance road trips. Super comfortable, but it holds together when you get to twisty roads. Really, really fun. I remember my favorite thing to do was just to brake hard and then just a sharp turn in. I could do that over and over in that car. It was just so satisfying. So I don't know, maybe have a look at the Kia Stinger. But also, I mean, if you can get a Cayman in that price range, do that. That's just a fun car.
Yeah, for me, whenever somebody says Cayman, I generally tend to kind of like try to like sort of confirm that lean, because I really am a big fan of the Cayman. To me, you can't beat the midship platform. I think it's a beautiful looking car that in some ways is like trimmer and more like direct and distilled than even the 911 has been for the last few years. 911 is obviously a singular experience that if you need a 911, nothing else will do. But if you kind of like put aside that, I love the Cayman. It's really, like I said, well-tailored, and the platform, the dynamics are just, so spot on. I think you got to do a little bit of looking to probably find either the Cayman or the BMW, like in these price ranges, because you're looking at cars that are like getting into that modern segment of collectibles that I think are going to start, going back up on the V or the U curve or whatever. But I'd probably go Cayman. Stinger's a creative choice there, John. Wouldn't have thought of that. I think when I tend to think of like cars like this, I tend to think like that sort of time frame, if you will, that era. But yeah, I'd go Cayman. That's what I would do. Any final thoughts, guys?
I really miss driving the Cayman, and I would love to drive one again sometime soon, as now the weather's getting nice.
Getting any fun cars there, Pross?
Just had the 4xE, and I'm also going to be, there's going to be an East Coast, a 90 minute drive with the Audi, that e-tron.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. That.
The GT?
Yeah, exactly. E-tron GT. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Sweet.
So I'm going to do that next week or Monday, the 10th. So that should be fun.
That will be fun.
Yeah.
Sounds awesome. I just got a text saying a European spec Volkswagen GTI will be arriving at my house any minute. Ooh. So I am super psyched about that. I think we should end the podcast.
So jealous, man. So jealous, dude. Are you kidding me?
This is one of those things that sort of like kind of pops into your like, just that they randomly become available. So I'll have a first drive on that coming up. Have the car for about a week, so I got to drive it and get into it. But GTI is one of my favorites, so can't wait to see what the newest version is like. Thanks for hanging out this week. Always fun there, John. Pross, thanks for joining us. Check out his work on Yahoo Finance, and obviously on Yahoo Finance Live, all the shows. Have fun on that Audi drive.
Thanks, Ray. Great to be here, man. Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Send your Spend My Monies and your questions to podcast@autoblog.com. Be safe out there, and we'll see you next week.